to childhood memories of Ladybird books and the stories that many of us read as children. While rereading today's story of Jesus' encounter with Zacchaeus, I was taken back to happy memories of fuzzy felt pictures. I don't know if you remember fuzzy felt, it was a greatly thing greatly beloved of Sunday schools. And as a young child, I would stick a felt Zacchaeus onto a felt tree, watched by a felt crowd. And in the picture, there was always Jesus, who in felt always had one hand in the air. So I was taken back in these memories to the creak of old floorboards in a church hall, and that particular smell of dust mixed with floor polish. But we want to dig deeper than perhaps Ladybird books and Fuzzy Felt can take us. But thank you to Fuzzy Felt, because it picks out for us our four characters of the story today. We have Zacchaeus, who's the title character, the tree, the crowd, and of course Jesus, who's not the title character, but as always is the main character of the story, the one who holds the mirror to us in this story, invites us to follow him, and changes us in the process. So, Zacchaeus, the title character, what do we know about him? We know his name. This is a historical account detailed by Dr. Luke, the writer of the Gospel, whose writing is always clinical in its detail. Luke doesn't waste words. If he's written something, it's there for a reason. So here's Zacchaeus, named as a character in history. This isn't fiction. And the doctor has observed this encounter and commits to writing in detail as he's found something worth communicating. Luke wants us to know that Zacchaeus was the chief tax collector and that he was rich. He was rich because of the oppressive tax systems that the Romans had instituted at that time in the first century. Taxes were levied on the Jewish people, and there was a particular tax for the Jewish people alone. And individuals in a community were given the right to collect those taxes and hand over to the Roman authorities at the end of the year the correct amount. Often the tax collectors were the only ones in the community with any knowledge of how much the taxes were, and so there was ample opportunity to take a little bit on the side for themselves and to feather their own nest at the expense of the local community. Zacchaeus was wealthy, and it's likely that he had extorted from the citizens of Jericho for his own gain. It's hard to imagine how hated the tax collectors were. They were regarded as collaborators with the oppressive Roman regime in a system which lent itself to economic injustice. Rabbinic literature of the time despised people like him. Lying to tax collectors was condoned. And really importantly, Zacchaeus and his whole family would have been regarded as ceremonially unclean. So they'd been shut out from the religious practices of the day. They would be unwelcome in the synagogue and have no part in the local community. The words tax collector and sinner were interchangeable. I wonder who might run through your mind as a modern day equivalent. People who've become rich through manipulating economic processes in our own capitalist world, who have effectively extorted money from their own communities by swinging a system to suit themselves with a lack of integrity, a lack of honesty, a lack of justice. Greedy people who have snatched for their own money which belonged to other people. I wonder if there is anybody who goes through your head. Are you angry with them? And would you go so far as to say that you hate them? Hold these people in your mind as a parallel for how hated Zacchaeus was and how isolated he was, how rich and how lonely. And also very small. He was too small to see over the heads of the crowd. A respected man would simply have asked the crowd to make way and let him through, but not for him. You can almost feel the backs of the crowd closing ranks against him in their hatred and their exclusion of him as he tried to pop his head up to gain sight of Jesus. So he did two very unusual things recorded in Dr. Luke's detail. He ran and he climbed a tree. Middle Eastern men would not have run. It was considered a disgrace. Just as the father in the parable of the prodigal son would have brought cultural disgrace on himself by hitching up his tunic, exposing his bare legs and running down the road to meet his son, so Zacchaeus did a shameful thing in Jewish eyes at that time by running in his efforts to see Jesus. And he also climbed a tree, another thing which people of stature and standing would not do really anywhere in the world in the public arena. Respected people would not be seen climbing trees at a public event. So here he is, our title character. He's despised, he's hated, he's isolated, he's lonely but rich, unclean. Here he is, Zacchaeus, further disgracing himself in his efforts to see Jesus. I wonder why he was so keen. And then we come to our second character, who's the tree. Luke identifies it as a sycamore fig tree. That would have been a large spreading tree with thick, dense leaves and low hanging branches that would have been easy to climb into. The Jewish statutes of the time didn't allow large trees to grow in the cities and the towns. Writings of the time specify that a tree may not be grown within a distance of 25 cubits of a town, or 50 cubits if it's a carob or a sycamore fig tree. A cubit's about 18 inches, so this tree that Zacchaeus climbed would have been about 75 feet from the edge of Jericho, from the city walls. And further, a tree was considered to be like a tent, and any activity involving ceremonial uncleanness in any part of that tree was transferred to anyone under that tree. So here we are with Zacchaeus, unclean, having made this tree unclean, having disgraced himself deeply outside the town walls by about 75 feet. Why did he do it? Was he trying to hide in the thick leaves? Was he intrigued by Jesus but ashamed to be seen by him? Had he hoped that the crowd would have dispersed by the time Jesus reached this tree at some distance from Jericho? Had the crowd noticed him running and climbing? We don't know. But we do know that Jesus noticed this lonely, isolated man and called him by name. He stood within the unclean boundaries cast by the tree as he looked up into its branches and asked Zacchaeus to do Jesus the great honor of offering him hospitality in his own home. It's really hard to imagine how shocking this must have been for the people witnessing this event. Jesus was the one who'd been feted and greeted by a crowd going out to him as he approached Jericho. They'd approved greatly of him healing the blind man. You can read about that in chapter 18. And they'd come into the city in very high spirits, welcoming Jesus as one who would have been expected to receive civic hospitality from the important people of the city. But firstly, he says, I'm not stopping here. The chapter opens that Jesus was passing through Jericho. So presumably he said, I'm not stopping here, I'm on my way to Jerusalem. That would be shock number one. And then shock number two came shortly after that. He said to the crowd, That's okay, no worries. So, shock number one, I'm not staying in Jericho. Which takes us to shock number two, I'm going to stay with him, pointing at Zacchaeus. Going off to stay at the house of this despised collaborator. You can almost hear the gasps amongst the crowd as people begin to think, what's he doing? What's going on? This isn't really how things are done round about here. which takes us to our third character, which is the muttering crowd. Luke, who's so careful with words, uses the word murmur. The crowd murmured amongst themselves. The word is found in two other places in the Bible. Earlier in his gospel, he writes about Jesus being surrounded by the same kind of people as Zacchaeus, sinners and outcasts. And at that point, the teachers and the Pharisees started muttering, "He welcomes and eats with sinners." So echoes there in that writing of Luke's of the same situation here, people witnessing what Jesus does and beginning to mutter and comment on what he's doing. It's the same word. And the same word is used when the Israelites were having a hard time after the Exodus, when they were coming through the desert, and they started mumbling and muttering against Moses, saying, "Egypt was better than this." It's the sound of people beginning to realize that things are not quite turning out as they expected, coming to terms with some uncomfortable things which take them out of their comfort zone. It's the sound of a crowd changing its mood, taking stock of something new and not entirely welcome. So in this story, we sense the shift to hostility, the questioning beginning, the criticism, the finger pointing. They're uncomfortable with what's going on. They're challenged by what they've just witnessed. They're scandalized by Jesus. They're scandalized by the grace of his gesture to eat with Zacchaeus. For Jesus is here challenging, as always, when he encounters establishment systems and religious power, subverting these by his words and the way that he does things. He's been traveling down from Galilee through the hostile desert terrain of Samaria, and he's now set his direction towards Jerusalem for his final days there, all the while using the landscape to teach and to begin to illuminate to his disciples that the unfolding story will be different to what they may have expected. He's told them on the approach to Jerusalem that he will die there, on the approach to Jericho, that he will die in Jerusalem. You can read about that in the middle of chapter 18. And we're told that that's too big a truth for the disciples to begin to comprehend at that time. It's a disappointment which was at that point too big for them to embrace. But in his interaction with Zacchaeus, he gives a harbinger of what's to come in Jerusalem. He stands in the ceremonially unclean place in the shadow of the tree. He shifts the disapproval of the crowd to himself, and he absorbs their anger. He deflects that anger from Zacchaeus, and in accepting the hospitality of heart from Zacchaeus, he brings salvation to that man. Scurrilous Zacchaeus. Jesus cuts through all convention with this subversive act of grace. He dismantles the religious structure of the day with a simple meal. In this story, we begin to hear resonances of what is going to happen in Jerusalem. In the honor of a shared meal with an outcast, Jesus subverts all the accepted narrative of power, establishment, and hierarchy. This is the wild and the scandalous Messiah on his way to Jerusalem. It would have been completely shocking for those who were there to eschew all the honor that Jericho could offer in order to eat with the lowest of the low. And the shock waves go on and on. He states, "Salvation has today come to this house." That would have been blasphemous to the ears of those listening, because no rabbi, no teacher could determine or offer salvation. But then there's a further shock. He says, "This man too is a son of Abraham." This man, ritually unclean, he and all his family are welcomed in to be part of the covenant community, part of the community to whom God made his promises through Abraham. "You'll be my people and I'll be your God." You can begin to understand the outrage on hearing what Jesus was saying. So no wonder the crowd muttered and murmured and wondered what was happening. And for the disciples, trying to teach about the nature of Jesus' mission, here he was revealing the harbinger of what was to come. In this act of grace towards Zacchaeus, a man who had undoubtedly done much that was wrong, who by his own greed had set himself outside of ritual and social acceptance, to humanize unacceptable to God, Jesus was giving indication of his coming great subversive act of grace. In Jerusalem, where becoming numbered with the transgressors on the cross, by dying in the unclean place of criminals outside the city walls, by becoming all that was unclean and unholy, by becoming sin for us, humbling himself to nothing, by doing this, subverting all systems of human power, all embedded religious establishment, fulfilling all requirements of covenant judgment and law, and opening the way for all, universally all, oppressor and oppressed, rich and poor, weak and strong, tall and small, to be restored to God, to be saved in acceptance of his hospitality of heart and his sacrificial love. Christ's grace, offered in humility, subverts unjust human systemic power. Zacchaeus took the oppressive power out of the Roman taxation system by offering back to those he had robbed four times the amount. He gave half of his belongings to the poor. He likely had very little left for himself, but he had taken the oppressive power out of the system locally by acting in imitation of and in response to Christ's grace to him. In our times, more recently, Christ's grace was offered in humility by those believers who gathered in the square in Bratislava in 1988 with lit candles, many of them elderly, in the peaceful protest against the harsh regime which had killed many of their bishops and trampled their churches. This humble act is regarded as the starting point for the Velvet Revolution and the dissipation of communism. In acts of humble grace, the grandmothers of the former Soviet Union, the babushkas, while the state closed their churches and persecuted their priests, sang songs and rocked cradles and told their grandchildren stories of Jesus, who had extended grace to them and of his enduring love. They raised a generation of believers who today in Russia thank their grandparents for their faith. The grace of Christ had so affected Martin Luther King that it compelled his insistence on non-violent protest in the civil rights struggle in America. And grace takes us to the mothers in Peru in the 1990s, who, having lost their own children to the violent revolution, took to collectively cooking meals for children who had lost their own parents and who were orphaned and on the streets. In doing this, they began a force for peace, which is thought to have dismantled the power of the violence and was the beginning of the end of the terrible revolution. It may be costly to the individual, but grace offered in Christ's name subverts and dismantles unjust human power. So locally, are we looking for the outsider, those shut out by systemic power? Are we looking for those shut out by the way we do things in churches? Are we willing to face ridicule or rejection of the mainstream crowd in order to seek out and honor those who are disenfranchised and dishonored by our systems and our social norms? Are we willing to call by name those who feel ashamed and shut out, to offer friendship, shared meals, hospitality? Are we willing to extend grace to those who have wronged us, in recognition of the immense and boundless grace shown to us by Jesus in his sacrifice for us. Because if we are, and we are, but there's always more, we will begin to see amongst us, as he works amongst us, history changed in the wonder of his love and in the power of his grace. Amen.